economic empowerment, creates social empowerment, and then creates political empowerment. Mm. A lot of these women were considered by their community as less than. Once mm-hmm. they start generating income, their status in their community also changes. That often translates into political power, either because they've decided to run for public office or because they have decided to come together as a group and ask for cleaner water, better services. This is a really fantastic cycle, right?
Welcome back, everybody. Rich Ricker, founder of Collective Responsibility, here tonight with another edition of the Mission Driven Podcast. Through this podcast, I'm trying to inspire and equip the next generation, the current generation of mission-driven entrepreneurs. Profit, nonprofit, I don't really care. In this episode, I'm extremely excited to be joined by Natalie Kylander, the president and CEO of Trickle Up, an organization whose mission is to partner with women living in extreme poverty to build economic opportunity and drive inclusion. Natalie, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here to speak about not only the work that you're doing, but also your own background, your own mission in this space. And as a starting point, it'd be great to have you introduce yourself and a little about the mission that you're on.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to share our work. Is really to enable nonprofits to implement their mission. And more specifically, I'm really committed to the economic empowerment of women. Across my career, that has been a theme that has really sustained me. And that is what I would say is my personal mission.
And then Trickle Up, what is the work that you're doing there? Who are the communities you serve? And how did it all come about?
Trickle Up's vision is a world free from extreme poverty. And the reason why we focus on women is that we know that when women have resources and the agency or decision making over those resources, they invest in three things: health, nutrition, and education. That is the best way to interrupt intergenerational poverty.
Now, when it comes to the cycle of poverty itself and breaking that, you mentioned the intergenerational nature. Is the work that you're doing trying to alleviate today's concerns of poverty, or are you really looking at a medium to long term?
Yes, it's a great question, and I would say it's both. So our work is really anchored in the graduation approach to creating sustainable pathways out of poverty for women. And so within a 2-year period, the women in our program are really creating livelihoods, are really gaining the self-confidence in themselves and in the future to create sustainable and resilient livelihoods. So that has an immediate impact. And they're then investing in their families and their communities. So there is this sort of longer term ripple effect to our work as well. It's really a solution to the problem of extreme poverty, one woman at a time.
What's the starting point for many of these women that you're working with?
All the women we work with are considered living in extreme poverty, living on less than $2.15 a day. In addition, the majority of these women are from rural communities, last mile communities, and most of our women tend to be either from indigenous populations, tribal populations, people with disabilities, as well as people who are refugees or experiencing forced migration. So these are really vulnerable, excluded populations that really haven't had the kind of opportunity and support that others have.
Okay, so they're underserved, they're rural, they're under forced migration at times, they're clearly under the $2.15. Is that really what makes for a great entrepreneur? Like, is that the foundation that we should be starting with? Like, why are they the candidate, and why is entrepreneurship, say, the theory of change or the medium of change for you?
So just to be clear, I think, you know, everybody has the potential to be an entrepreneur. It depends a little bit how you define an entrepreneur. But if it is the ability to work hard, to learn, to innovate, to come up with solutions to problems, I would say that, you know, most of the women that we work with have a capacity to do that. Mm. The other thing that I think is really important about our program, Richard, is that we bring these women together into savings groups. And within these savings groups, they work obviously to build savings, and they also support each other in their transition to becoming an entrepreneur.
But you're working with tens of thousands of women across, you know, three continents in very kind of tough conditions, I would argue. How are you identifying them, and what's the onboarding process? Are you working direct with all of them? Do you work with partnership? How do you identify all these candidates?
But we work through and with local community-based organizations and really help and support them. those organizations, those partners, to identify and provide the programming on the ground. The mm-hmm. reason why that's important is really twofold. The first is that these are community or based organizations that have members that are often from the same communities that we wish to serve. So they speak the indigenous languages, they understand the mm-hmm. culture, they can build the kind of trust that is needed. The second reason is that by building the capacity of these local organizations, we're really creating a sustainable model. And part of that process, we sort of have an approach to triangulating who are the participants. They're often the women who are living in the periphery of the village. And so we do some mapping exercises with community leaders to really understand who is not being included in any programming, who is the most vulnerable in their community, so that we are making sure to include that population that we really want, which is underserved and often, you know, unrecognized.
What else is happening in the regions that you work with, and how do you work with other organizations, or how does your platform fit into what's already happening? So it allows for a wider community, a wider platform of support.
It's a really great question. So it does depend on the geographic area that we're working. So for example, in India, we work with a lot of particularly vulnerable tribal groups. Okay. And in some cases, they aren't even on any official registrar. So part of the work that we're doing is helping them connect with the government services that they're entitled to. So that's one component. The second one, I'm going to take you to another geographic area. I'm going to take you to Uganda. And there are a number of organizations working to support different aspects of the needs that these refugees are experiencing. So there we do work with other organizations, other nonprofit organizations. Sure. There we stick to our lane of livelihoods and economic empowerment. But we also connect in with other organizations that can provide services to that population. I mean, one of the interesting things to me, Richard, about the development sector is that we're pretty siloed. So organizations tend to be either focused on health, focused on education, but the populations that we want to serve and reach really have these multiple needs, interact with a number of different organizations to get the support they want. And so it seems to me that there is an opportunity to be more holistic.
You have an individual or a community that sounds like at times they're on the move. So it's not like they're setting up a storefront that's fixed. They're moving along with, you know, with the ecosystem, with the economy, with their communities. How are you helping them? Like, is it funding? Is it classes? Is it mentorship? Like, what do you do to help them get going and to make sure over this 2-year program that there's a positive outcome?
So, well, just one correction. I mean, the populations that we work with, and even if they are displaced or refugees, are not necessarily constantly on the move. Okay. In fact, they're refugees that are resettling. There's some crazy statistic, like the average refugee stays in the refugee camp for about 17 or 18 years. So these are not mobile populations necessarily. These are populations that are trying to rebuild their lives in their host communities. There are sort of 4 main components to our work. The first is creating savings groups. These are the groups that I talked about where 20, 25 women get together, literally pool their money and put it in a box. And so that is their first sort of, that's the first component of our work. The second component is around training. And that incorporates things like financial literacy, skills-based training, all the kinds of things that you would imagine to support an entrepreneur as they set up their business. And for many of those women who are illiterate, you know, these are new ideas. They seem pretty obvious to us, but for many of them, these are new ideas. And then the 2 other important components is that we provide seed capital. It's a grant. It's not a micro loan that helps them establish their business, have some working capital, or buy some productive assets. And then the 4th and perhaps the most important component is that we provide a lot of coaching. I mean, it's hard to be an entrepreneur under any conditions, right? And so providing these participants with, you know, a degree of coaching and helping them in their transition as they start their businesses is really very important. And so that's mm-hmm. the fourth, and I'd say probably the most important component okay. of our work.
And I'm thinking, like, a lot of the entrepreneurs that I work with and that maybe you know in kind of your own community, like, there's a lot of overcomplication in trying to find, you know, unique and innovative and scalable solutions. But when you strip it all down, is this community, do they, by not having as many resources, by not having as much choice, does that make it easier for them to get started and therefore the options are more limited? Or actually, are you finding, like, some really out of the box thinking comes out of this?
Both. I'd say both. So they tend mm-hmm. to start with things that they know, which could be food production or animal husbandry or small shops. Very often they're starting small shops. But what we've seen is that as they go through the program, they build a little bit of success. Then they're starting to be a little creative. So for example, in rural India, I met a woman who'd started a birthday cake business. That is really interesting to me, because that is not part of the culture, but with access, you know, to social media, the concept of celebrating a birthday with a cake is really spreading in rural India. And of course, you can't buy birthday cakes in rural India. So she's, you know, this woman taught herself through, I think it was through social media, basically, to bake a cake. But, you know, one of the things that we're working on that I'm really interested in is this idea of group enterprises. So, okay. If you think about it, a lot of these individual are building resilient livelihoods for themselves and their families, but they don't necessarily scale that business, right? But when we're experimenting with group enterprises where women are coming together in groups of 12 or 20 to create much larger businesses, and that is really interesting to me, because we are seeing, obviously, they're getting cheaper inputs because they can bargain and they have more market power, and they're accessing larger markets. There was one business I just saw where they're making brooms, you know, out of twigs, and they have so much demand that they've started hiring people from adjacent villages. So we have seen some really exciting group enterprises emerge from our work as well.
How much money are we talking about, maybe turns over in a month? A few hundred dollars, a few thousand dollars?
It's definitely less than 1,000. I mean, remember that these women live on $2 a day.
Right.
And so, you know, I think I would have to go back to get the exact numbers, but they're sort of doubling, you know, their okay. income.
How does success change them, family dynamic, great and their question. Communities?
Yeah, great question. So what we've seen, and I think others have observed, obviously we're not the only ones doing this work, but what others and we have observed and others have observed is that economic empowerment creates social empowerment and then creates political empowerment. So a lot of these women who before really were considered by their community as less than, once they start generating income and saving money, their status in their community also changes. So some people will come to them for advice. For example, you're successful, you've been able to do this. How can you help me do the same? So the social status changes, and then what we've seen is that often translates into political power, either because they've decided to run for public office or because they have decided to come together as a group and ask for cleaner water, better services. You know, this is a really fantastic cycle, right? I mean, economic empowerment creates what I think, you know, sort of self-confidence and the ability to exercise agency. And that can create more economic power, right? So it's a really great flywheel. And I think we've noticed that in all of our work and all of our settings.
On average, assuming that this is a success story, how long are we talking about before the start of your program to where you can start seeing the women have attained that kind of that empowerment, that social capital, or whether it's like, when does that start to happen?
Yeah, I think once they start having some success in their business, they start shifting and I think believing in themselves a lot more.
Yeah.
So, and there's also a shift in the gender dynamics in these communities as well, right? And you're seeing what's always fascinated me is what's going on when there is a savings group that is coming together to save money or to get a training. What, first of all, women are playing leadership roles in those groups. They are the president, the secretary, the treasurer. They run these meetings themselves. Mm. And so they're sort of exercising leadership within that group. But what's also really interesting to me is that there are children and young adults that are sort of sitting on the periphery, that are looking in.
They're seeing the role models.
Yeah, exactly. So both boys and girls, right, are sitting there and they're looking and they're observing and they're listening. And what are they seeing? They're seeing women who are running businesses, saving money, women that are coming together in solidarity to support each other and to promote savings, women who are playing leadership roles in their communities. So we don't have a good measure for what that ripple effect is. But I can tell you that if you're a young girl looking in on this, it doesn't feel to you weird or impossible to run your own business because you can see it.
You know, once this flywheel starts to happen, do you as part of your programming really promote the idea of paying it forward as well? And, you know, so that those women, if they succeed and as they succeed, you kind of create this obligation that they should then help the next generation, or does that just naturally happen?
It's hard enough trying to start your business, run your business, feed your kids. I don't think it's fair in a way to put that on them, but I must say a lot of them do it naturally, right? A lot of them sort of play this coaching and mentorship role. And it goes back to the sort of this issue of social empowerment in the sense that if you are recognized as a successful woman, then people will defer to you, come to you for advice. And that is a role that a lot of our women do play. But it's not an obligation that we place on them unless that's something that they really want to do.
I want to shift this a little bit. Sure. What does it take to do all this? How many people do you have? What are the resources required, and what are some of the things that you look at every day to kind of grow your impact, create efficiency? You know, like what are the things that you're really grappling with?
So I'd say just to start with the team, we're about 60 people in total. The majority of our staff are actually in country. So in India, we have about 25 team members. In Latin America, we have about a dozen. And then we have a couple in East Africa. And then in the US, we mostly have a team of fundraisers and finance, right? That's sort of our core operations, as well as program quality. A lot of the work in terms of relationship management, partnership management, implementation of programs, and increasingly fundraising too, is being done at the regional level.
These regions are some of the fastest growing regions now: India, Africa, Latin America. As they come up the economic development curve, does that change the nature of your work? Does that change where you're working? Like,
I mean, Trickle Up's been doing this work for over 40 years. So we have a solution that works. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, there is an appetite by governments and by large INGOs to incorporate components of economic inclusion programming, which is what we do, into their own work. So that's very exciting because that is going to really move the needle in terms of the number of people that can be reached. But it does, as you suggest, shift our role a little bit. So instead of just implementing through our local partners and being very close to the ground, I think there's an opportunity for Trickle Up to play more of an advisory capacity building role with some of these larger organizations. And so increasingly, we see our role as an enabler for others to adopt and adapt the programming that we know works.
All right, so I'm going to flip this around on you for a second. Ask, what's this journey like been for you? Because you mentioned that you're in the private sector before. I mean, you were in academia as well. So what have you learned about yourself? What do you get out of empowering and overseeing an organization that empowers so many other people?
I mean, first of all, I have to tell you, this is very joyful work. You could imagine that working with people in extreme poverty, kind of facing the hardships and challenges, could be you know, could be draining. It's actually the opposite, Richard. I mean, these women are smart, they're joyful, they're hardworking. It's just very joyful and and beautiful work. So I just feel really lucky to be involved in an organization that is like everybody is focused on this, and it's very challenging. It's very interesting and also very challenging, and it's sometimes frustrating. I can't understand why people aren't just giving us money.
Yeah.
And so, well, sometimes when you have to justify your work and you have to, I think it's understandable. And a lot of the best funders ask you great questions that make you stronger. So I'm not suggesting that funders shouldn't ask questions, but it can be really grueling.
Now, assuming that our listeners have stayed along with us this long, they're clearly inspired by your work. And I'm curious, what piece of advice would you have for, say, a young woman who's seeing the space as maybe a career for themselves, or they want to be a part of this? What are two or three things they should do to get on board, get on mission, you know, and deliver impact?
I guess I would say take a step back and say, don't worry too much about the career path and getting to the next level. Worry more about what creates energy for you. So there are certain activities that can feel depleting and certain activities that can really feel energizing. So I would say pay attention to that. You know, pay attention to the kinds of people that give you energy, as well as the kind of activities that create energy for you. We're all different, right? And so different things about the work might feel harder or easier. And I would say, you know, lean into what feels like it gives you a lot of energy. That would be one thing I would suggest. Don't worry too much about getting to the next level. I've got a career that's a complete patchwork that makes no sense at all. And at the end of the day, you pull on all the threads and the experiences that you've had, and you make your own tapestry, right? And so don't worry about this sort of linear progression. Think about gaining experiences in a lot of different areas, in a lot of different sectors, and then you can weave your own story together from those experiences.